Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
This hour, we're in depth on why it's more complicated than just an urban-rural divide. That's the shorthand of this election. Angry white rural voters overwhelmed more diverse metro-based voters, thereby emphasizing a trend that's been developing for decades. That's the shorthand. But it's much more complicated than that, of course, and we're going to talk about why. And I think this is the perfect place to do that. Our upper Midwest region of Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, and the Dakotas has a few densely occupied cities, lots of wide open, less populated spaces. So as our guests join us this morning, I'd like to hear from you. If you live in a smaller town or a rural area in our region, do you feel like your political and cultural perceptions are all that different than those of us who live and work in cities? And then flip this around. What do we share that could make us more cohesive? So if you live in a rural area, do you feel like you think differently, you consider politics and the culture quite differently than the people who live in cities, even in our region, even in the state of Minnesota? And turn this around, what do we share that you think could make us more cohesive? Here's the phone number on that, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2820, online at nprnews.org/live, and I'm on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Dante Chinney is with us. He's director of the American Communities Project at American University and a writer for the Politics Counts blog. And we must be catching you on vacation, Dante. I see you're near Sarasota, Florida. So welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
It's good to be here.
And Jeff Guo is with us this morning. He's a reporter for The Washington Post. He's recently written about rural and urban America, and he's with us today from near Washington. Jeff, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, Jeff, I feel like that shorthand of the 2016 election boils down to rural versus urban. It doesn't say that much, and it's become the shorthand that I think readers and listeners are hearing and not really understanding all that well. What kind of context would you add around that?
Well, I would say it's not even just rural, right? It's also small town America. It's white working class America. You hear the term Rust Belt thrown around a lot. It's all of these ideas, and they're all, you know, connected to this sense of, you know, America like it was, you know, in the 50s and 60s when the economy was booming, when it was easy to get a really nice paying union job. I think all of these ideas are connected to economics in some way as well.
Yeah. And you've been talking to a political scientist in our area, right, in Wisconsin, who calls this rural consciousness. So what do you understand that to mean from her?
So I think maybe a good place to start is with Thomas Frank's book, What's the Matter with Kansas, which came out, I guess, more than a decade ago. And he had a theory that a lot of rural voters, you know, were voting against their own interests. They were voting for these Republicans who weren't going to give them any jobs, were actually not helping their communities in any material way, but that they had been hoodwinked with these messages about the culture war, stuff about abortion, right, or stuff about gay marriage. So that was his thesis. But then I talked to Kathy Kramer recently, who's a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who's been going around rural Wisconsin talking to all these voters. And she really dislikes and has, I think, disproven the idea that that all of these rural voters are voting against their own interests. And it's an insulting idea. And she, by talking to them, you know, at length and for years, she found that the way that they think about politics is rooted in a sense of it is rooted in values, but it is also rooted in a sense of, you know, real economic decline and a sense of suspicion of urbanites and of city people. And they feel that the reason why they oppose a lot of things like Obamacare, for instance, it's not that they don't realize that Obamacare has helped them. They know that. They're not ignorant, right?
Yeah.
But they also feel that they're suspicious of it, and they feel that the costs outweigh the benefits. And that's where that's where we see the difference in values, I think.
Yeah, Dante, I want to take a call for you. And luckily for us, the first caller is from what I would call rural Minnesota. Leslie, would you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay, good. What are you calling to say? How are you thinking about this?
We live rural. I own a small business in Cambridge. And I think rural people tend to be far more conservative in their thinking. We don't want to see our taxes go up on properties that we've worked very hard to, earn and enjoy. Many of us have larger pieces of land, and we see our property values going up. And then there are issues such as gun rights. Many people that are rural are hunters. We don't want to see that change. Of course, rural people are a huge religious community. I am not as religious, mm-hmm. but I find that, they're just more conservative thinkers, such as abortion and, gay marriage and things like that. And so I think people in our rural communities just basically had enough, and they didn't want to see this country changing to a more liberal way of thinking. No one in the country or the rural parts are interested in the peoples coming together and creating more of a socialist community.
Okay. Yeah. Leslie, stay with me for a minute, if you would. I want to give Dante a chance to reflect on what you've said, but then I have another question for you. So, Dante, what do you hear in what Leslie's saying?
Well, I mean, it's definitely true that rural America is different from urban America in basically every way you can imagine. I mean, it is. It's more. There's more land. There's more space. People tend to own more land. And culturally, it's much more conservative. Those things are all true. The other thing is, demographically, it is much more homogeneous. That is also true. I know that there will be people who will say, no, that's not true. We've had growth of Hispanic population where I live and so on and so forth, or there's a small population. And that is true. And in terms of the percentage change from what that place was before, it may look like a lot. But look, I spent a lot of time looking at these demographics. Those places are much more homogeneous racially, ethnically, and, and diversity extends beyond really race and ethnicity. People who live in rural communities do tend to view the world more in the same way because this is the clustering effect of what the country is right now. The people in rural America are more religious. They tend to have attend services more often. They do have lower incomes. They have struggled more economically. Look, it's the rural urban divide. It isn't just the rural urban divide. It's completely true. Blue collar America. There's a category that I think about when I think about America that I call middle suburbs, and they're all around the country, and they're around big cities. They're white. Less wealthy, less educated, and they went very heavily for Donald Trump after going very slightly for Mitt Romney. So it's a bigger concern. But this urban-rural divide is really about everything. It's about different ways of kind of living in the world and perceiving the world.
Okay. So, Leslie, I want to come back to you on something that Jeff talked about, which is this idea that people in rural communities don't really know what's good for them because they vote against their own interests. You're probably aware of that. I'm not saying it's held by, people that live in cities. There's just this perception that is how rural communities are viewed. Do you feel that? What do you think about that?
I guess I would have to say that voting against their own interests, I think rural people tend to be very strong in their values, and they want to provide for themselves. Mm-hmm. So more so than taking from a government or social program. So in other words, if they're hungry, they're going to go hungry. They may go out and shoot small game or grow the garden and do some canning. They're more sustainable people, I guess I would say.
Jeff, what do you hear in that? And thank you, Leslie, very much for calling. Good to have your call. What would you say, Jeff, to that?
Well, I'm thinking, my mind's going back to all this stuff around Obamacare, right? This is work that Kathy Kramer has done. Sarah Cliff at Vox had a great piece about this a couple weeks ago. They've both gone out and talked to rural voters and asked them, why do you hate Obamacare so much? Is this a matter of political messaging, or do you have real complaints? And what they found is that people know about the benefits that Obamacare has given them. They know about that your kid can now stay on your insurance until they're 26. They know about all these rules making insurers give you care even if you have pre-existing conditions, stuff like that. But they feel that but they also see their healthcare costs rising, and they see that the costs have outweighed the benefits. And so there is, I think, also a sense of economic rationality here at play.
Yeah. You know, Dante, here's what I find confusing about this so-called rural-urban divide, because a bunch of the rural counties who supported President Obama's reelection in 2012 and supported him in 2008 in places, again, in our region, Iowa and Wisconsin, voted for Donald Trump. I don't understand how this changed so significantly, if this divide is as deep and as permanent as we seem to suggest. How could that kind of change happen in 4 years?
Well, a few things happened in those counties that flipped. A lot of counties in Iowa flipped. That's an excellent point. And a few things happened. Look, if you look at the data on this, a lot of these places declined actually in population. There were many counties in America that seen declines in population between 2012 and 2016 that saw increases in the number of vote cast. Okay, so rural counties actually turned out more than they have in past elections. There's long been this theory among Republicans that there's this hidden missing white vote out there, and it revealed itself in this election. It does to some extent exist in some places in the country, in particular Iowa, Ohio. You see it in counties like Luzerne in Pennsylvania, Franklin in Pennsylvania. You can see it all around the country, these little counties. So what happened was a couple things.
Dante, are you there? Might have dropped his phone line just as he was getting to something really interesting. Jeff, what would you say about that? We'll try to get Dante back on the line.
No, I think he's absolutely right there. There was this kind of white vote that turned out. But I would point out that, the white vote, the vote overall declined in this election for both candidates. It just declined more for Hillary Clinton than it did for Donald Trump. The other thing I would add is that there was a non-insignificant part of the population that voted for Obama in 2008 or 2012 and then also voted for Donald Trump in 2016.
Wait, I want to understand what you just said. You said a non-insignificant. Okay, what does that mean? It's a double negative there, Jeff.
I guess what I want to say is there are definitely people out there who did that. The counties that flipped, I don't think it's just a matter of differential turnout.
Okay.
I don't think that's enough to explain why some of these counties, some of them went from minus 10 Obama over Romney to plus 10 Trump over Clinton.
Exactly. This is why I'm confused about whether this trend is just something that happened because of other circumstances in this election or whether this is really something, worth examining as significant.
I think part of the long-term thing is the sense of disillusionment with the economy and disillusionment with the way that the country is developing. And if you look at the similarities between Obama and Trump, in some ways, they're very similar because they both ran as these outsider candidates. They promised change. They promised, I don't think Obama ever used the term clean the swamp, but he definitely promised to bring change to the district. And so I think that there are voters out there who saw the same message and respond to this idea of Washington's not doing things right. Washington needs to be reformed. We need someone with an outside voice to come in and fix things. And that's where, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama diverged, because Hillary Clinton couldn't really claim that outsider mantle. And I think that's one of the reasons she lost voters.
Okay. So, Dante, we heard most of what you said, but just as you were, just as you were going to get to kind of the demonstrative point there, we lost you. So what were you going to say?
But the point is, and thanks, sorry about that. The point is, and I've been listening in, it's not about the similarity between Trump and Obama. It's about the dissimilarity between Trump and Romney. Okay, One of the things that happened in this election was Trump has taken the Republican Party in a different direction. He has. Now, I don't know if this is going to prove to be a fruitful direction in the long run, but what he has done is he has said, I am the party for working class America. I am the party for all you people who have been left behind. I'm the guy who's going to fix all these problems for you. And I've been out since the election. I've been out to Macomb County. I've been out to West Virginia talking to voters. And look, they understand that he's not going to do all that stuff. They really do. Even the people who voted for him. But they like the way he speaks. And they think he's speaking their language. And he's talking about, can he fix it? They don't know. But he's at least talking about it. A lot of these people feel as though they've been left behind and there's nothing for them anymore in the way the country is moving. Romney was not going to fix those problems. Romney was the inside. I mean, he was not a Washington insider, no, but come on.
Mm. Very establishment, you're saying.
He's a banker's banker, okay? Right. He may not be an insider's insider, but he's a banker's banker.
Right.
Son of a governor, former governor himself. Yeah, Trump could appeal as the outsider, and these people got fired up and they turned out for him. And the urban-rural divide, we'll see what happens. It is a question now of will the Republican Party go down this Trump road? How far down the road can they go? Remember, Trump believes in things or says he believes in things that are not in line with the Republican Party.
Right.
Trump is anti-free trade, right? Trump is actually pro-government spending, he says, which you go to West Virginia, that's what they like to hear. He's going to build roads here. He's going to invest. He's going to invest in infrastructure. Now, will he do all those things? I don't know, but that's a real fight that the Republican Party is going to have. Trump is trying to redefine the party, and if he does, the country's going to look different. American politics is going to look really
different. Jeff, just briefly again, because I think we talked a bit about this, that is why I look with some skepticism at all this analysis about how deep this rural-urban divide really is.
Why?
Because of exactly what Dante just said. Because Trump is an anomaly in some ways, and I don't know that we can take the votes that supported Trump as an indication of some deep change in the way we think rurally and urban-wise.
I mean, I would agree with that part. I would agree that these are issues that have been long there and that Trump found a new way to speak to these kinds of voters.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. This is a conversation, if you've just tuned in, I want to hear from more of you on the phone lines as well, where we're trying to kind of suss out this idea of the rural-urban divide that you've been hearing a lot about since Election Day. We're putting some context around that, weaving in some data that our guests are bringing us this morning, and then asking you, because we're in an area where there are some city populations, but we have a lot of less populated, a lot of rural areas in our region, and Minnesota and Wisconsin and Iowa and the Dakotas. And I'd love to hear from you this morning on that. If you live in a smaller town or a rural region in our area, do you feel like your political and your cultural perceptions are really significantly different than those of us who live and work in cities? And turn it around, I wonder what we share that could make us more cohesive. You know, we've been talking a lot about that since the election. So 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at Kerri, KERRIMPR, where Eric says, I'm also rural in upbringing, and a lot do and will not recognize benefits from people, quote, outside their group. Tribalism at its best. And another listener here says, grew up in a small town. They think they're real America and city people, i.e. non-white, are not. Racism is at the heart of it. Dante, is that fair or true?
I would say that race, I don't know if I hate using words like racism, but there is definitely a difference between people who live in some places who don't see a lot of diversity around them, having different feelings about race and others. And the real America thing is really problematic to me, because the fact is there is no real America, okay? It's all different kinds of places. They're as real as urban people is as real as they are, and it gets troubling.
You sound weary of having to explain this, Dante. That's why I'm laughing.
Because I am. It gets, after a while, it does get tiring to explain to people that, like, we're real America. It's like, you're not any more real than anybody else, and they're no more real than you. It's just the way life is, people.
Dante Chinney is with us with that pungent analysis. He's the director of the American Communities Project at American U, and he writes for the Politics Counts blog. And Jeff Guo is with us. He's been writing a lot about these issues that we're talking about today. He's a reporter for The Washington Post, and you can find some links to his stories on my Twitter feed after the show. Okay, to the phones here to James in Fauston, Minnesota. Hi, James. Thanks so much for waiting. What are you thinking about on this?
So just kind of a point I wanted to make and maybe have people see it from a different perspective. Being from a small town, what you notice largely is that they are affected by changes quickly and more visibly than in urban areas. You hear a lot in rural areas that they refer to the Democratic Party mostly as snowflakes, as young individuals in college and things. Mm-hmm. Where out in the rural areas, they are very, very focused on vocational jobs, hardworking, and they want to gain the fruits of their labor without paying it towards someone else. And they're watching in communities in Minnesota. They're watching this cultural spike of other people who are injected into small towns, and they very much change the face of the town. Mm-hmm. When America makes when Trump makes statements like "Make America Great Again," people tend to remember the times before changes that were bad in their recent history, and that's what they kind of believe that Trump is going to do. Whether it's a refugee population, whether it's illegal immigrants, they are very focused also on those vocational jobs, which once were they were proud of, they could do, but they are being taken on by a different culture, and now people are turning their noses down and turning away from those things. And you see that very, very much impacting the rural communities.
Jeff, what do you think of that?
I think that's absolutely true. I'm thinking of the conversation that I had with Kathy Kramer, where she, you know, she pointed out that there's a lot of, I guess, lack of knowledge about how urban areas operate and about the people in them. And just as much as people have been saying after the election that, you know, we should be going out into rural and small town America and finally listening to their grievances, we should also, you know, rural America should also come to the cities and come check it out and figure out what is, you know, where America is going.
Yeah.
And one thing,
Jeff,
go ahead.
I just wanted to say, I read your piece, I think it was titled something like Rural Dwellers Live in a Bubble Too. And it came
mm-hmm.
from that letter that you got from Rich Hepworth, who
mm-hmm.
said, hey, this is a two-way street. And in part, he wrote to you, my rural friends don't understand the problems and dreams and unfulfilled expectations of their counterparts in the urban areas. That really rang true to me.
Exactly. And one example that I heard is Kathy Kramer went out and she was talking to these rural voters, and they told her, you know, when she told them that she lived in, you know, Madison, they're like, oh my God, how's the crime there? Are you worried about black crime? And she's like, well, no, not really. It's actually, you know, pretty safe. But, you know, these messages and these stories sometimes get a little distorted as they traverse the divide.
Yeah, Dante, this reader that wrote to Jeff added, my rural friends have been conditioned by 30 years of right-wing radio to automatically distrust anything that smacks of elite privilege. Is there some truth to that, do you think?
Yeah, well, everybody lives in a bubble. I mean, this idea this is what I mean by there's no real America. Look, we live in a world now with the internet and cable television, and you construct the reality you want to live in. And we all construct different realities that we want to live in. Some of those are the physical reality we see around us every day. Some of those the virtual reality we live in online, okay? It gets very hard in a country that is divided with all these different bubbles in terms of governing. It's very difficult to govern in a country like this. One thing I'd say to the caller nobody should denigrate vocational training, and nobody should denigrate manufacturing work. These things are real jobs, and they built the middle class in this country, and they made this country great. I understand that, and I believe in that. I am from around Detroit. I understand that really well. But the thing I also understand is that those jobs are not being taken as much as you think by people in other countries. They're going away to machines. And I will tell just very quickly the story that I've told many times before, which is I grew up outside Detroit. As a kid, I went to the River Rouge plant, and they made Mustangs. I took my kids back there a couple of years ago, walked through the same plant. I saw docents. They had docents who work on the factory tour, who used to work at the factory. And I told them, you know, it looks like there are a lot fewer people than when I came through here as a kid. And he asked when I came through, and I told him, you know, mid-70s. And he said, there's about half that number here.
Wow.
And he said, there will be about, and I said, I was shocked by that. He goes, that's nothing. He goes, if you go over the new plants in Scandinavia, there's half this.
Really?
We just don't need the people anymore. We don't need them. I mean, the bottom line is those jobs, which were real and which built this country, a lot of those jobs are going away, and we have to help people make it in the new economy. We have to. But I do think it's a fallacy, and I think you're kidding yourself if you think we're going to bring back everything we used to have. Again, I grew up in Detroit, man. I watched this happen for 20 years. It's a lot of these things are just gone. And we've got to find a way to make it in a different and a changed global economy. And that's just reality.
I mean, the other thing, Jeff, back to the heart of the topic that we're talking about, if manufacturing in any way is coming back, a new and different kind of manufacturing, as Dante suggests, it's probably not going to, these factories are not going to be built in, for the most part, as we've experienced here, northern Minnesota. They're going to be built near cities where there's, ability to transport goods, and you've got the workforce and you've got the educated people that you need to bring in workers for those factories. I don't understand why that appeal was so attractive to so many people that live in rural areas.
Well, let me say first off, I totally agree with Dante. These jobs really aren't coming back. And even if they are, all these advanced manufacturing jobs, they're mostly coming back in the South where labor is a lot cheaper. So it's not like Detroit is going to become a manufacturing hub anytime soon again, or a bigger one anyway. But I also this is something that is not unique to Donald Trump. This obsession with manufacturing.
Uh-huh.
Barack Obama has done the same thing. He's talked a lot about manufacturing, even though, and he's a smart man, and I know he knows that that manufacturing is not going to be the future of America's workforce, but it still sounds good because this is where I think it gets into a little bit of political messaging. It just sounds good to people. It sounds good to be able to say that you do a job where you actually physically make things instead of, like writing about ideas.
Well, that's American mythology, right? You're making stuff with your hands. That's like at the heart of the American myth.
Right, yep, exactly.
Dante, you were adding?
It's part of the hipster scene, actually, in Brooklyn and Detroit now. Now it's like super, super downscale. Like, I make my own candles. But it is part of the American
But mythology. You're not going to employ, enough
no,
people to really make a difference in that economy. That's great for you and your candles, right? But
that's absolutely right. Or the Shinola Watch Company.
Right.
It's a nice idea. It's wonderful. But, let's be realistic about how many people that's ultimately going to employ.
But where this gets dangerous, yeah. I think, if I could add, is because automation is so difficult to make a villain of, people instead, right, turn all of their attention onto the smaller fraction of jobs that have been taken away by trade or that have moved overseas. And this also translates into resentment of immigrants and foreigners and outsiders. And this has been something that has been so active during this election, and it hasn't really been rooted in reality. There's a real sense of, finding someone to blame, even though the real villain is, I guess, among us.
If you've just tuned in to the conversation this morning, you're hearing Jeff Guo from The Washington Post and Dante Cinni, director of the American Communities Project at American University. And we're taking apart with some data, with some analysis here about this idea of the urban-rural divide. I hate even saying that because I think that just feeds into a very simplistic kind of understanding of what it means to live in an urban area and what it means to live in a rural area. Although yes, there are differences and there are different ways that people in these different areas are thinking about politics and culture and American identity and the changes that are coming to America. And so I'm asking you today, depending on where you live, if you live in that rural area, how are you tracking this conversation? What do you want to add to this discussion? If you live in an urban, if you live in the cities here in our region, whether it's in Des Moines or you're living in the Twin Cities or you're listening in Madison, I'd like to hear your thoughts, too, on perceptions about those of us who live and work in cities. 800-242-2828. 651-227-6000 on Twitter at @CarrieNPR. Patrick says, yes, separate social tribes. Each group thinks the other's values are misplaced. I can hear my pa now. That's for city people. We'll get a look at the latest news. We'll come right back. Stay with me if you're holding on the phone lines. I want to hear your ideas about this, but to Mike Moen now. Hi, Mike.
Hello, Carrie. A main Syrian opposition group says it supports a nationwide ceasefire that's set to go into effect at midnight local time. But the Syrian National Coalition says it'll defend itself if attacked. The Syrian army announced the agreement with Turkey to halt fighting, saying it paves the way to reactivating negotiations to end the conflict. The government's latest report on unemployment benefits suggests a solid job market. The Labor Department says fewer Americans applied for jobless benefits last week, with requests for aid falling to a seasonally adjusted 265,000. Over the past year, the number of people collecting benefits has fallen almost 5%. German prosecutors say they've released a Tunisian man saying he wasn't in contact with the main suspect in last week's Berlin truck attack. The 40-year-old was detained in Berlin on Wednesday. A spokesman says they determined the man wasn't a contact of the man believed to have driven the truck that plowed into a Christmas market, killing 12 people. And Russian military officials say they're not ruling out foul play, but they say that flight recorders reveal no evidence of an explosion on board the Russian military plane that crashed into the Black Sea last week, killing all 92 on board. Officials say they've listened to cockpit conversation in which the captain indicates a special situation unfolding on board. Statewide forecast today has a wind advisory in effect for west, central, and far southern Minnesota. We'll see some scattered snow showers in some areas. Temperatures holding steady in the 20s, 31 degrees right now in the Twin Cities. More news ahead on Minnesota Public Radio News. It's 9:38.
Did you just happen to miss the biggest book show of the entire year yesterday at 9 o'clock? Good news for you. You can find the whole list on the thread, nprnews.org/thread. You can listen to the whole show on my podcast, nprnews.org/Carrie Miller, or wherever you get your podcast, just download it and make it a New Year's resolution to sign up for a podcast. There's a lot of great content there, and I'd love to hear what you think about it.
ClimateCast is supported by Benjamin Franklin Plumbing. Together with Mike Rowe, Benjamin Franklin Plumbing supports skilled plumbers who have the tools and expertise to get the job done right the first time. Benjamin Franklin Plumbing, the punctual plumbers. 877-BEN-1776.
Programming is supported by the University of Minnesota's School of Social Work, celebrating 100 years of preparing students to build a better world. More on the school and its 100th anniversary at socialwork.umn.edu.
Back to our conversation now. Jeff Guo with us from the Washington Post and Dante Cheney with us from the American Communities Project. And to the phones to Brittany in Minneapolis. Hey, Brittany, thanks so much for waiting. I really wanted to hear what you had to say, and I appreciate you hanging with us. So welcome.
Yeah, thank
what are you. Thinking
you.
About? Sure.
Like you were saying before the news, this way of urban versus rural way of thinking about it is very simplistic, and I think a lot of us see that and live that. Personally, I am from a more rural area of Minnesota and have family from very rural parts of Minnesota and South Dakota, and now live and work in Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm.
And so I see these rural versus urban kind of stereotypes playing out on both sides. And I think a lot of other people can identify with that feeling with the move toward more urban areas. A lot of people still have more rural roots and so see that it's not just a dichotomy. It's a very much more complex issue. And I think, you know, when we look at it in this black and white way, it only feeds into those stereotypes and misconceptions and skepticism. Even within, you know, the people I know well, there's the skepticism of, you know, people who live in the city or people who live out in rural areas. And I just wanted to call in and say that I do think it is much more complex.
All right. Really good to have your call. I'll take Marie in Ellsworth, Wisconsin. Now, hey, Marie, hi. Thank you for waiting. I'm interested in how you're thinking about this.
Well, I kind of disagree with the last caller because where I live, I do see that divide. It's not really simplistic, but definitely very obvious, particularly through this election. I think, though, the gentleman that was talking on your show about how manufacturing has changed is a good example. I don't think that Obama and Trump had the same message. I think President Obama, when he was running for election, he talked about clean energy and jobs in those ways, whereas Trump, I think, painted that picture, bringing back the 50s, bringing back coal, and the things that we know aren't going to be, with automation, available, like you were talking on your show.
Yeah.
But I do see, you know, we had a, I had a person say to me, it's not fair that the cities get more votes than we do out here. And that just painted the picture for me. It's so true. They just feel overwhelmed, and they want to keep and preserve what they've always known, and they're good people.
Yeah.
We've been living in this area. Both my husband and I came from cities, but when we raised our children, we raised them around farmers. And they are good people, but it's very hard for them to believe the changes that we know are here to stay.
Dante, what would you say about what Marie is bringing into the discussion?
Well, I mean, it's I think that rural Americans shouldn't be angry that there are more votes in urban America. Votes are just where the people are, obviously. I think that the reason that I would argue the reason that Donald Trump won this election was because that vote really kind of came out. And it's not just rural America. That is unfair. But look, I look at the election. I have these 15 types that I look at with the American Communities Project. You know, some of the differences between what Trump got out of rural places as opposed to what Romney got out of them are just remarkable. I mean, places that I call rural Middle America, Trump did 17 points better there than Romney did. Working class
wow.
country, Trump did 17 points better there than Romney did. Graying America, Trump did 10 points better there than Romney did. These are all rural communities that had an increase in the number of votes cast, and they had an increase in margin. I think rural America should be patting itself on the back. If we're going to think about the split this way, they are really, I think, in large part responsible for Donald Trump winning. I will say, however, just quickly, that for Donald Trump to win re-election, if indeed he runs for re-election, he would need to build this base he's built. He's going to have to make inroads into more, at least, ex-urban places, and that's going to be an interesting interesting path to watch.
It sounds to me like, Dante, you're saying he's really to hold the confidence of the people that have given him a chance. He's
yep.
going to have to deliver.
He's got to do something.
So, Jeff, here's what I'm curious about since we've started talking about electoral politics again. Isn't it true that Bill Clinton, can you think of another Democrat since Bill Clinton who was really able to transcend the divide, was able to get, you know, significant amounts of votes in smaller rural southern communities and activate a lot of these voters in urban areas? Has there been anybody else since him that's been able to do it?
I feel like that's a trick question. I think that in recent years, the
Democrats... It's not a trick question, Jeff.
In recent years, Democrats have become a little bit obsessed with the way that America is changing, and they see that, you know, we are going to be a minority-majority or a majority-minority nation imminently. And some people have argued that there's maybe a sense of complacency that, oh, you know, the minorities are going to that's not a good way of putting it. You know, demographic change is going to put us at an advantage
yes.
in the coming years, right? Well, it seems like right now the answer is not yet.
Right. But why do you think my question about Clinton is a trick question? I mean, isn't it true that President Obama activated voters in urban areas in such large numbers that he was able to, and I know Hillary Clinton even fell shorter of that, but he was even able to win without the kinds of voters that she needed and that Trump got?
I mean, I think that Obama did speak to a lot of rural voters. You can see how well he did in Iowa and how poorly Hillary Clinton did
yeah,
in Iowa
right.
this year. And so I think he did, at least compared to Hillary Clinton, he had a better way of speaking to them. And
Dante, you sound like you want to get in on this.
Yeah, well, the thing that really happened with Obama, when you look at the data, is he made the Democrats a suburban party. The Democrats own the big cities, and they own these densely populated urban suburbs. And this typology that I have, Hillary actually did better than Obama did in big city counties, counties mm-hmm. holding big cities.
You got within the cities, okay.
Yes, okay. So the counties around the cities, too. So Wayne County around Detroit, Cook County around Chicago. But she also improved on his margin in these big, dense urban suburbs, and that was really the triumph of Barack Obama. He took these big, kind of growing suburban populations that were they were diversifying. The suburbs were diversifying, but they were still very well educated and very wealthy, and made them Democratic. And Hillary Clinton actually did hold on to a lot of that. She didn't get the vote she needed out of the big cities, but the problem was she didn't get quite. She improved on his margins, but she didn't turn out all the votes she needed in those places, and it wasn't enough to kind of overcome this tsunami, really, of kind of less wealthy white suburbanites around Detroit, Chicago, Milwaukee, and really in rural parts of America. And remember, Hillary Clinton still won the popular vote by almost 3 million
votes.
Yes,
that's right. Call here from Mark at Fort Ripley. Hey, Mark, hi. Hey, Mark, hi. Are you there?
Yes. How are you doing today?
Doing good. What are you thinking about?
I want to bring one more attribute to this, and for your guests that are not from Minnesota, I want to share with you a term that they reference us in Minnesota as we are the outstate Minnesota people. And I want to reference this because I think this is another attribute that hasn't been talked about. I heard some really good things today. But being from outstate Minnesota, which they call, I feel I have never been so far disassociated away from our political process and government as I do today. Mm-hmm. And I would add to this conversation, I actually think I voted for a person who once again would go to Washington and represent all of the people. And I think as an outstate person, I feel that politics is Jeff definitely drawn towards the inner cities, the policies, everything that's being enacted is for the inner cities, and being outstate, I feel my voice, the people that represent me in politics, don't represent what I need in outstate Minnesota to be successful with where I feel our economy and our local outstate government needs to go to be successful.
Yeah, Mark, this is really good. I'm glad you called because Jeff and Dante, you're hearing like a microcosm of the debate that I covered at the Minnesota State Capitol for years. That's exactly how it sounds. People mm-hmm. that live beyond the cities are referred to as outstaters.
Right,
there is this idea that they want very different things and they want more than their share. I mean, I think any politician that was really being candid would say, you know, there is a very different kind of cultural perception of state government at our state capital and many others. And I think Mark has kind of crystallized that well. Dante, Jeff?
Well, I'm just curious. Is the caller still on the line?
Yeah, Mark, are you still there?
Yes, I am. Yeah. I am driving, and I apologize if there's background.
Don't crash. But I'm just curious, what are specifically the things that you'd want? I guess that's the question.
Well, when we talk about jobs and the policies and the programs, they're all wonderful. But being in outstate Minnesota, I feel that the availability to those programs for the people of need, and they're just not as represented and organized as well out here. The programs don't make it to outstate, and I'm fortunate enough that don't have to use those. But I just feel the people in outstate Minnesota that have those needs struggle. I feel our roads aren't as well. Our education schools aren't funded as well. You know, we put up big dollars to build stadiums, which all helps, you know, all of Minnesota. I love the Vikings, but I don't utilize all the gifted money that gets put out from our government for all those things that happen in the urban communities. So it seems like there's an imbias towards what is being gifted and granted and enacted in an urban setting versus rural.
And there are legislators, of course, and Mark knows this, Dante and Jeff, that, you know, from the cities that will say, we send a lot of money out to, look, we have needs to, you know how that goes.
Right, of course. Yep.
Yeah. So what did you hear, Dante, and what Mark is saying?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing is, and a lot of this calls too, it strikes me how much these are conversations that would have been, these are things Democrats would have said 20, 30 years ago, right?
Yeah.
And they would have said that they weren't getting a fair shake from the Republicans. You know, the Republicans used to be the suburban party, and in some cases even the urban party. If you flip, the map is flipped from like 1976. If you look at the way the vote goes in cities versus rural areas. I think the thing that strikes me most is what he's calling for in a lot of ways is government, right? And it's a fairer shake from government,
but
government being involved,
yeah.
that's fair, right?
Yeah.
I think I hear that from a lot of the rural places I go, and I've been to a few of them. I wonder if Republicans in Washington feel the same way.
Yeah, that isn't get government out of my life, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And I think what Dante is saying gets at another schism within the Republican Party that we've seen, right? All of this kind of the small government, make government good for business, this trickle-down stuff. That stuff, it turns out that was not an essential part of being a Republican voter. It turns out that this other stuff, this sense of alienation, the sense that the country's going backwards, that these were much stronger, more motivating feelings.
For 2016, anyway.
For 2016, yeah. Anyway. Right?
Yeah. Call here from Joe in Long Prairie. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Carrie. When I hear people like the last caller, it kind of reminds me of when a husband and wife are fighting over, who does the dishes more. You know, it's not about the dishes. It's about, do you love me enough?
Exactly.
And I feel like, Same thing about when I hear about the economy. I think it really comes down to that they think their values are being trampled underfoot.
Yeah, but and, are they? I mean, that's the question.
Well, let me give you a contrast, which is
okay.
I know people, I know farmers who have worked with their grandfather and father at the same time in let's say their grandfather was from, quote unquote, the greatest generation, who went through the Depression, fought in World War II, and who believe what makes this country great is hard work and discipline and self-sacrifice. And let's say that person tunes into your show and they hear a discussion about how, well, at this school, rather than making people who need to be on the free lunch program stigmatized, we're just going to put everybody on the free lunch program. That way nobody has to feel stigmatized. And I think the contrast there is really what kind of starts out this feeling of, well, we also aren't getting our fair share from the government, or we're getting shafted by the economy. But I think it comes down to that they feel like the philosophy of the greatest generation is being trampled underfoot and being replaced with something else.
Yeah. Joe, I'm glad you called, and Dante and Jeff, I think this sounds a lot like what our first caller said when I pressed her a little bit and she started talking about self-sufficiency. And I actually think I hear Joe saying the same. And it comes back to, Dante, I think you were saying it. Your values are not any more real. They might be different, but they're not any more real or pristine than the values of people who live in the city. But I feel like there's some superiority, the sense of superiority in this idea that there's a place in America where self-sufficiency, is our principle, and that's not in the cities of America. What would you add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. The other thing I'd say is about when we start talking about the differences in the values that people have is,
yeah,
I think some of what's coming here is they sense the country is changing rapidly, and they don't like how fast a lot of people who voted for Trump look. A lot of what's going on, Make America Great Again, is that things are not the way they used to be. We need to get them back again to the way they were, and they have a feeling that things have changed rapidly. And honestly, they have in many ways changed very rapidly now. Think of how fast things moved on gay marriage. And also, I think this kind of change that's happened economically, it's been going on for a long time. It's been going on for a really long time, but we had a couple of bubbles that kind of got us. Then we had a tech bubble that got us through some times. We got a real estate bubble that got us through some times. And then we had a collapse. And now we're kind of coming back after the collapse. And it could just be, I just want to throw out the proposition that, what we're seeing economically now, 2% growth, 2.5% growth, this may just be the way things are for quite some time.
Right.
And people don't like that. And I get that they don't like it. And it feels like it's changed very quickly.
You know, Joe's still on the line. Let me come back to him on that. Do you think that's part of it, Joe? When you talk about values and what Dante just said?
You know, I it always comes back. People turn it really fast towards the economy. I think that is an expression of dissatisfaction with something that is deeper. I know in central Minnesota, I have a friend who works at a technical college there, and both our friends call both of us kind of liberal conservatives. And so he is definitely not the type to say these things without thinking, but he works in a tutor center, and in the favoritism, you know, that is shown to the culture of immigrants is very strong, and they talk about it a lot there and respecting that and what great culture they have. And if I was a farm kid who went to that technical college, I would hear all that and I would think, well, what about my parents and my grandparents and my great-grandparents who grew central Minnesota to what it is, who went through all the sacrifices to make this place great.
Joe, forgive me for this because we've only got about a minute and a half left, but I'm going to come back and give Jeff a word on this. Jeff, I do hear what Dante said about this on this discomfort with some change, just in what Joe just said.
I think that we, in a lot of ways, we're not so different and the divide is not so great when you think about it this way. We have all been through a really rough economy. We've all, you know, seen technological change and automation and all of these things reconfigure the way the American economy works. And in this election, we've seen, you know, voters who I think at the core of it are voting because, as Dante said, they're uncomfortable with that. And moving forward, the question is, you know, what kinds of policies are we going to enact to change the way that the country is headed? And that's where I don't know if we can there's a clear answer on that.
This was really interesting. Dante, Jeff, thanks much. And I want to say a big thank you to listeners who called in to give us some perspective. Thank you. Good to have you both here. Hope you'll come back.
Thanks so much.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Coming up at 10 o'clock, we're talking about ways to spur new and fresh creativity in writing. One of those ways is a little experiment we're going to have some fun with. If I gave you the first line of a story, could you write a really fun story with that first line? We'll talk about that and other ideas. That's coming up at 10. Stay with us.